2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse Show. Maria Chalaios, along with Ton Bettis and Cameron Alcott from Progressive Plants, joining us this morning. We've been talking about trees and the best kinds of trees to plant in your area. We do have a texter who has a question this morning, guys. This person says they grew up in Oregon. They've always loved the Douglas fir trees, but they're not sure that they will work very well here in Utah. They'd really like to find a nice, small, pure, middle-shaped evergreen tree that they can put in their backyard. It's a south-facing backyard. They live in Spanish Fork, and they're wondering about your suggestions. Cameron?
Douglas fir may work at their location. Kind of depends on where you're at. I mean, they are native here, too. I mean, I see them up in the mountains when I go hiking and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of different cultivars that you could do down there. It mostly depends on how much drainage that it gets. Most conifers don't like to sit and wait wet feet. So if they're a little bit closer to the mountains, I would say, you know, really probably go for it and see how it works. If not, if you're in like some of the more flatter areas, I'd say look at some of the members of the pine family. There are some wonderful columnar mugos, Bosnian pines that kind of have that, you know, more of a columnar and, you know, pyramidal type shape.
You bring those up, and in my experience, those Bosnian pines and the columnar mugos tolerate a wide range of soils.
They are a really versatile plant. I really enjoy them. I mean, if I have to use like an evergreen, like a conifer in a really difficult area, you know, like the areas that we were talking about earlier, they work very, very well.
Okay. So we do have a caller this morning calling from West Valley City. Good morning. I'm not sure who's on the line this morning. Good morning. What's your question?
Yes, I have a four-year-old burr oak in my back property, which I absolutely love it. And I was just wondering if there was any of the red oaks that do well here.
The red oaks, that family, in my experience, they do okay more on the east side more than anything. I haven't really seen a whole lot on the west side.
USU has been playing with Texas red oak, which is Quercus bucklii. And of all of the red oaks that we've played with, we've tried three or four species, so it's not like extensive. But of them, the Texas red oak seems to tolerate our alkaline soils a little better, but it's very unavailable. And so it'd almost be one that it's a Schmidt. Schmidt carries it. But it's also a zone 6 tree. And so along the Wasatch Front, I'm fairly confident in it. But if you lived in Logan or Heber, I would not plant it.
Yeah, I would agree. I'd look at maybe some of the, we were talking about the chinkapin oak earlier. That one's really nice. And maybe the Shamardi oak. That one's supposed to tolerate really high pH.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You bet.
Thank you for your call this morning. Cameron, you were talking about when people are planting their landscapes, first thing they should look at is water and what their water source is due to the salinity. What is the second thing they should be looking at?
Really just maybe aesthetics at that point of what they're really trying to accomplish. You know, whether they want to have like, you know, large trees, usable areas, and just kind of think about how they want to live in their yard more than anything. A lot of people come to me and just be like, hey, just make my yard pretty. I'm like, whoa, hang on. Wait one second here. How are you going to use your yard? Are you entertaining a lot? Do you have children? You know, those are the types of questions that I like to try to ask, because then, you know, I want to have like, you know, wide open spirit, like areas for the kids to run around with. And you know, where do I want to have the color? Where are the viewpoints? You know, that type of thing. Do they want to have a garden? You know, things like that, because it's kind of hard to retrofit sometimes, especially after you get like your irrigation in, and you know, if you have to get equipment to kind of level everything, and then, you know, 3 years later you're going to come in and change it, like it gets expensive after a little while.
What do you think as far as focal points?
I'm a big plant guy, so I will find focal point trees or interesting shrubs more than anything. I'm not a huge fan of lawn art. or pink flamingos or anything like that. You know, everyone's a little bit different. But I like to really find things that are just unusual.
You would love my stone turtle, though, because
would
everyone
I?
Does.
I've got a neighbor that makes like a whole bunch of like metal type monsters and stuff. I think he sells them around here, like trade shows and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. But he's not disparage them. Some of us love
it's,
them.
It's actually his stuff is really cool. Like I would use his things because his mailbox is unbelievably cool. You know, but I like to find things that are just really different. Either they have like an interesting shape to them, or they just have a color scheme that is just off the wall crazy. So, or just, you know, like little pom pom type. Like crab apples and stuff where you're just, you know, kind of like a stick on a – with a little ball on it. It's just the foliage and flowers.
Well, when I talked to, you know, Jerry Goodspeed, who's one of our extension agents, but he's also a landscape architect by trade, one of his favorite plants are the little lollipop type crab apples because they're just so durable.
Yeah, they're tough as nails, and you can get them in different shapes. You know, some of them kind of grow like out and a little bit more horizontal. Others, like a Cinderella, for instance, just kind of grows in a little ball. And you can, you know, prune them every spring and try to keep them, you know, really like kind of like lollipop shape. So I like to do some funky things like that every once in a while. And there's like new varieties of plants that I am chomping at the bit to really start using those in landscapes. There's some really cool things that are on the horizon coming out this year.
And we should tell folks that's why you're here today. We're going to be talking about some of those at the top of the 9 o'clock hour when we have a larger segment.
So, Maria, as we talk about this, one of the, I think, the biggest mistakes people make is to roll into the nursery in the middle of May and buy pretty things just because they're pretty. And then go home.
We've
and
all
say,
done this. You know?
Where are we going to plant this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is the biggest mistake people make because what's blooming in May won't usually be blooming in September, and you have no idea of the sizes.
True. Yeah, and that actually brings up a really good point. Is you know, if I do a design for somebody, typically what I'll do is I'll design the trees and a lot of times the shrubs because those are expensive mistakes if you plant the wrong thing. You know, trees are expensive to remove, and once a shrub kind of gets to its mature size, it's really hard to pull that out easily. So I'll usually try to plan that a little bit more, but then I will leave spaces for people to go to the nursery when they're, you know, looking for something pretty, and I'll tell them, don't buy just one, buy like six. And you just go put them in this area and just plant all of them together so they kind of grow into like a little bit of a mass. And sometimes I'll encourage them to go to the nursery, you know, every 2 months or so, or maybe even every month just to see what's blooming. Because if they just go and buy the stuff that's pretty, you know, in the months that they're there and then they just go home and plant them, then they will get some color all throughout the year. But you have to be diligent about going shopping.
This is a great time of year to do something that I did. I did have a landscape architect take a look and give me a basic design of our yard when we first moved in like 30 years ago. But at that point, we couldn't afford to do everything that they wanted to do. But I would, as I was planting things, I would write down what I was planting. And sort of, I had a kind of a plan, so I could kind of plan exactly what I wanted to put where. And then I would just fill in at certain times. But I did what you guys are talking about. You know, you get out there in the spring and you get excited and you plant a lot of things and you plant them way too close together because they're very small plants. And then before you know it, they're out of control and you're replacing them because it doesn't look the way you had planned it.
Right. And that's just, you know, the nature of landscaping. I mean, your yard's always going to evolve. You know, when we planted my mom's yard 30 years ago, it looks very different now than when we initially planted it. You know, things got big, you know, and you know, trees got bigger, so they started providing more shade. That affects everything around it, you know, because you can't plan for 30 years from now. Well, you can to a certain extent, but not like your understory stuff is going to start to get crowded out and shaded out at some point. You know, you're going to make changes to it every, you know, 7 to 10 years.
I was trying to think of what's still living that I planted 30 years ago. A few rose bushes, spirea that I planted around the front. The pine trees, which my husband wants to take out because now they are huge, even though they were just really small when we planted them 30 years ago. And that's probably it. The fruit trees have had to be replaced. Yeah, a lot of changes over 30 years.
Yeah, fruit trees, they can be a little tough because it seems like they have a lot of different diseases.
If you maintain a fruit tree well and that fruit tree makes it to 25 years, that thing's like Methuselah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen some really,
especially peaches, and cherries if you don't maintain them. And even when I talk maintenance, I'm talking spraying, but you can do this organically. 10 years mm-hmm. is Methuselah for an unmaintained cherry or peach especially. And so they are very expendable. But one thing you brought up and Maria brought up was that the landscapes are transitional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I see people want to do a static landscape that they plant once and walk away, it's junipers, turf, and maybe like some honey locusts.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, you can keep it trimmed and nice. And when you walk past, you're like, yeah, someone's taking care of their lawn. But there's nothing more than that. I think the best landscapes are always transitional, so that every 5 to 10 years, they oftentimes look very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. So like my mom's yard, when we did that one, we planted like, you know, a lot of beech trees, you know, and
which are great anchor trees that will be around for over 100 years.
Oh yeah. And they are absolutely gorgeous. You know, they are very large now. And it's been kind of interesting because they themselves have, their aesthetic has changed. Like their wood is more gnarled and, you know, the roots, you know, have now been exposed along the base of the tree. And now we can plant different things around them, like mosses and things, you know, where when we initially planted them, it was like, they were just getting sun just beat down on them.
Right.
And now it's a very different and interesting, you know, landscape at this point. So, but
the number to call to be part of the program this morning, 801-575-8255. You can text us your questions at 57500. We'll be right back.
A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are. And this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning. Thanks for taking us along with you. The KSL Greenhouse Show this morning, Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis, and Cameron Alcott. We've been talking about landscapes, planting trees, and how yards are really transitional. And I used to think, guys, that when something died in my yard, I was a complete failure, until my neighbor, who was a master gardener, Kathy, said, you just need to see this as an opportunity to plant something new. And it made me feel better, because plants don't last forever. They really don't.
They don't. And, you know, I think if you're going to grow as a gardener, you need to kill a few things. And I promise you, there is nobody in this room that has killed more plants than I have. I probably
a lot of English daisies and things that don't grow very well in our climate.
That's not fair. English daisies are going to die no matter what.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was growing for the nursery, I mean, man, I probably killed around, like, I don't know, 50,000 worth of plants or 50,000 plants a year.
Whoa.
You know, just because you're trying different things, you're trying different tactics and see how they thrive. And sometimes they just don't, or you apply too much of something or not enough. And yeah,
that's kind of what's fun about gardening, though. The experimental part of it, I think, is what makes it fun.
I completely agree. You know, and I tell people, don't feel bad about killing stuff. I mean, understand why you killed it, and you will be a lot better of a gardener at that point.
Mm-hmm. One of our texters is asking you guys, do you have a good app that you can recommend to manage your garden?
An app.
The gardening apps are tough. That's just what I'll say, because not only do you have to develop an app, but they constantly have to be updated.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can cost, and this is my experience at USU, anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 to develop a good app. And then it will cost you thousands of dollars a year to maintain it with current information, updates, things like that. And so USU does have some apps, so it will email you things you should be doing in your yard, but it's extremely live, very interactive. That gets a lot more difficult, because it takes thousands of dollars and almost, like, not really a full-time job, but someone constantly on it all the time. And so I think that's why we don't see more of them, is because it can't be static. And the app shouldn't be anyway, but the gardening type stuff that, you know, you would imagine, you know, those are a lot of work.
Right.
Yeah, and I would think, like, there's just nothing that really trumps experience, I think. Because, I mean, you have different scenarios that can happen on any given year, especially in Utah. where you have, you know, what's like a year or two ago where we had a flowering pear tree was blooming in January.
Yeah, flowering pears, especially in the Salt Lake area. Last year, last spring, we had green stink bug that we had never really seen it.
Yeah, that's right.
But
that's
not right. In the numbers that we saw last spring. And so it's so dynamic. That's some of what makes it difficult to do a gardening app for just all things. What pest is this? Mm-hmm. What flower is this? And there are some pretty good apps that you can take pictures of a flower and it'll bring back suggestions on what it might be. And that's mm-hmm. a little different, but an actual live, just all things gardening app. Oh man.
For a few years, I actually tried to just keep a written diary of when to plant things and when to
that's the best way.
Cultivate things. And that's a really fun way to kind of keep track of what happened the year before. If you're one of those people who really like, if you're a geek like some of us and you want to do that, it's kind of a fun way to know when to plant things and when to cultivate them.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the very best way to manage any type of garden is to literally keep notes over everything. Because at the nursery, we've got notes on growing, on everything that we do, when things bloom. How to plant them, what to plant them in, so we keep all of that.
Make a note of the weather that summer.
Make a note of the weather. Yeah. I mean, it's all about statistical analysis.
My grandfather kept some spiral, just paper notebooks that when he bought plants, among things, records he kept, he would tape or glue the plant tags with a date on what it was and where he planted them. And so as he was trying to find out what to do in the future or just how things did, he would just leaf through that. It's like, oh, yeah, this white rose was terrible. And that was his name. I don't want that one again. And so he'd make a quick list of the ones not to get. Mm-hmm. So he didn't accidentally, because there's so many varieties. But it was a great help. And even that, like the World War I Victory Gardening Guide we mm-hmm. put up, one of the things it talks about is being a good gardener is keeping thorough records of what you've done, how much you planted, what your yields were, if something died, why. And for the experienced gardener, it becomes very important.
I know, but I get so excited and I'm planting things and I keep all these tags and then suddenly there are all these tags just in a pot waiting for me to put them in my diary. So that's where I get caught up, right? I can't imagine how many little plant tags I have just sitting in a little pot that I haven't put into the diary yet.
I accumulate plant tags like you wouldn't even believe.
Let's go to a call this morning. Dan is calling from St. George. Good morning, Dan.
Hello.
Hi.
What is your question this morning?
What is your opinion on bonsai trees?
On a very future episode, we are going to be doing all things bonsai.
In fact, it's February 15th, so you want to tune in for that. But give your opinion. What's your opinion on
that? I think it's a fun hobby and very doable, but it's something that if you dive into that, you will at least want to get some books, Ortho or Sunset Gardens. Do you know of any good bonsai books? You could probably pick one up from the library.
Yeah, there's a lot of resources online, too, on doing that type of stuff. I really want to do bonsai. Probably won't happen until I can retire.
It takes time. And you have to take care of them. You have to maintain them.
Mm-hmm. And it's when I say hobby, it's more than a hobby. It's not quite a religion, but the actual philosophy of bonsai, there's a lot more that goes into it than to just making these cool sculpted plants. You've got to keep the canopy in balance with the roots and fertilize with certain things and even kinds of soil that will keep things healthy but not growing too quickly. And so there's a lot that goes into it. And if you want to get into it, I would look online, hit a library, and do some research. But in a couple of weeks, we'll have the Bonsai Club on.
Yeah, hope you'll join us on February 15th, and we're going to all learn more about that together.
Do you remember the old Ben's House of Bonsai down by Fashion Place Mall? That place was amazing.
I only was in there once, and it was just briefly. I was driving past, but it was amazing.
Yeah, I was probably like 16 or 17 years old when it was there, and I loved that place. I mean, there were just some amazing plants in there.
Dane, thanks so much for your call this morning. Let's take one of our texters' questions this morning. They say, this is from Mike in Linden, lives on the bench. He struggles with late freezes killing the stone fruit blossoms, nectarine and peach, and wiping out their harvest. 2 out of 3 years on average. Does it make sense to prune later to increase the odds of more blossoms surviving? If so, when is the best time?
Well, what I usually recommend if you run into those problems is in mid-March, if you're dealing with peaches and other stone fruits, do some of your major pruning so that you cut the biggest branches out, but you can wait until after danger of frost to do your detail pruning. And it's not that it's ideal, but we run into this quite a bit. I know several experienced horticulturists that will do just a limb here, a limb there to take care of things on a major scale, but they'll go back in after danger of frost and then just do some detail pruning to reduce the amount of fruit if they did have a good year. Now, with that being said, Maria, if they're getting frost 2 out of 3 years and it doesn't diminish, they may need to find a new spot in their yard where it has some slope and plant at the top of the slope. Look at maybe if they can planting a barrier of trees like an upright juniper or arborvitae that will block frost and put the trees on the other side. So there's some other strategies you can use, because pruning alone, it will help, but it won't eliminate the problem.
All right, next texter, similar question. They're in Logan, the current temperature 32. Cool. What dates would you suggest to start pruning apple trees? They haven't been pruned for a couple of years, and they just want to trim the suckers that go straight up.
Mid-February is when you do that on the Wasatch Front, or mid-February. So up in Cache Valley, they're usually 10 days to 2 weeks later than us. So right around the 1st of March is when I would start on the apples.
All right, let's take our next caller. Kathy is calling. Good morning, Kathy. What is your question?
Good morning. Hey, I live in South Jordan, and I'm putting in a new yard. And I bought a couple of ornamental pines, and I wanted to put them, well, not in the park strip, but in kind of a moon shape area that maybe is only about 8 feet wide, you know, and then it narrows out. How big is the root system going to be, and could I put it there?
What did you buy? Do you remember?
It was from Home Depot, and it just says Austrian pine, Oregon green, Pinus nigra, and, you know, they have the balls.
Yeah.
It's going to be 10 to 12 foot by 8 to 10 foot wide.
It might get a little bit bigger than that. The root systems on most of the pines are going to be, I don't want to like scare you, but they're going to be a little bit more on the shallower end, and they'll probably spread like a little bit wider. Oregon green is a more compact variety of the Austrian pine. So, and how wide was the area that you said that you were planting in?
It would probably be about 10 feet wide, but you know, it narrows. So the picture moon shape next to the park strip. Yeah.
And you know, that particular tree isn't going to grow incredibly quickly. So I'd say you're probably okay with it. If it's going to be a problem, this is probably going to be like a 15 to 20 year problem, I would think.
Mm-hmm. So not for a while.
Not for a while. I'd say go ahead.
You'll take up my concrete, do you?
It may. Hard to say.
But it would be yours down the road.
Yeah, you may not be living
so
in that house.
Hopefully, it would be the next homeowner's problem.
No.
Leave it for somebody else. I mean, are you talking 20 years? I don't know how long I've 20, got.
20 Oregon green. I mean, if it was there a long time, it may, but 20, 30 years, you'll be fine on cement damage. None will happen.
Okay. Yeah, if it was a regular Austrian pine, just like the straight species, I'd probably have a different answer for you.
I'm going to keep it. Can you cut the roots out? I mean, a little bit when you got planted. You can't go in and dig out the...
We're up against a hard break, so we're going to have to go, but don't root prune. And you won't need to for a long time with that tree anyway.
Kathy, thank you so much for your call this morning. And the number to call to be part of the program, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. We'll be back following the news.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was 3 blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.